Hello and welcome to C2Y Podcast, Discussions on Child and Youth Care. Today I'm speaking with Teresa Fraser. Teresa is a child and youth worker, a certified Canadian child psychotherapist, a play therapist, and is the current president of the Canadian Association for Child and Play Therapy. Teresa has worked for over 30 years with children and their families. She's on the faculty of Sheridan College, and Teresa and her husband are also foster parents. Teresa is the author of two books, Billy Had to Move, and more recently, Adopting a Child with a Trauma and Disruption History, A Practical Guide. I've asked Teresa to come and speak with us today about play therapy. Hello and welcome, Teresa.
Hi, nice to hear from you.
Beautiful to have you with us today. Thank you so, so much.
Well, I was listening to my intro and thinking, how'd you know all that? You must be a child and youth worker detective.
Yes, and you're a child and youth worker who's out there, so it's really easy to detect you. Before we even go into play therapy, I'd like to start with play. And you could tell us a bit about why play is important.
Oh, that's the most fun question. Well, play is the language of children, as we know, and play. Children learn throughout all phases of development using play. And I was just actually tonight. I'm at my parents' house with some siblings and their kids, and we were doing mealtime. And I was the three-year-old wasn't really wanting to eat, and his little baby sister's in her high chair, and I pulled out the spoon and started doing, you want the airplane or the train? And my older niece was like, he's too old for that. And I was like, no, he's not. So just doing the, and the, and he finished his spaghetti. And then the baby in the chair who wasn't wanting to eat too much started to pick up her spoon and started imitating, the motions and the noises. And that was mealtime. So play, whether we're using play in as, there's a difference between play and play therapy, obviously, but even working with families and helping them figure out how to have fun together and play. Any kind of intervention we do when we do family work, I always say to students, one of your first treatment goals should be have fun. Because if kids are having fun, then whatever you're working on, isn't work.
Yes. How does it slip from play, do you want the airplane or the choo-choo train, to play therapy? Where's that transition?
Yeah, in terms of how we officially define play therapy in play therapy circles, we usually go to the Association for Play Therapy in the States, their definition. And, I could look up the actual formal definition, but in kind of layman's terms, play therapy is you're using play as with a specific purpose in mind. And the belief is that a trained, clinician or a play therapist who's aware of all of the different modalities and uses play to navigate through those modalities, that's the difference between just hanging out and doing things, with a treatment focus and a purpose, and then therefore having hopefully the evidence to evaluate is what you're accomplishing successful or not successful, or, are your goals accurate? Maybe you need to rework the goals. Whereas play, and I think sometimes it can get blurred. I think I'll jump to why I even got into this field. And I was 17 in high school and read Dibs in Search of Self, and couldn't, and thought, I want to do that. That's what I want to do. And I remember sitting in Pat Ferbiak's office, who was the coordinator of the Child and Youth Worker Program at Humber College when I attended there. And in those days, before you even got into the program, you had a group interview, and then you had an individual interview. And Pat said, why are you here? What do you want to get out of this program? And I was honest and said, I really, I read this book, and, my parents have been foster parents my whole life, and I know I want to help kids, and I'd really like to help kids before they get into trouble or before they go into the system. And child and youth work, it was the only program in Ontario at that point that used playful therapeutic activities to help facilitate change for kids who had, in those days we called them emotionally disturbed, but currently we would say today kids who are having life challenges in whatever life space they're in, whether it's school, home, or community. So child and youth work for me really fits in terms of similarly between child and youth work and play therapy, in that child and youth workers really do use therapeutic activities to facilitate change, as well as the most important tool being relationship.
Yeah, certainly. And you've found a way to balance both of those, enhance both of those, do both of those simultaneously.
Try. I think to be honest, the kids always kind of bring it down to that level for us, your clients, right?
Yeah.
You know, whatever you're doing, if you can do it in a playful way to engage them, you're usually going to have a little bit more success.
Yes. So let's, to help all of us frame this conversation a little bit, could you give us an example of what a play therapy session might look like?
When your listeners do some research around play therapy, they'll hear the words directive and non-directive thrown around a lot. And non-directive play therapy would be the belief that the child comes into the play therapy room and they're shown all of the tools and given the opportunity to explore the room and the tools in whatever way makes sense and fits for them. That process would occur after an intake has happened and the therapist has looked at what the treatment needs are and consulted with members of the child's team, and may even have left out specific tools in the room so that, anticipating that these might be things that the child wants to work with. And my experience is, when I've worked with kids in a child-centered way, particularly with kids that where you're trying to begin to develop your relationship, or they've had such a colorful history and lots of trauma, that trying to initiate one direction or another really might not be the best thing for the child. So much better to let the child lead and the therapist follow. So that would be a non-directive, and sometimes people will also hear child-centered, really based on the work of Carl Rogers, right, in terms mm-hmm. of going where the client's at, letting the client lead. And then we move to our more directive play therapy models and interventions, which, the big buzzword right now is cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT play therapy. And that's because there's pressure on agencies to be providing services that are evidence-based, and because funding often gets attached to that. And also, when we're looking at directive modalities, those are the ones that, you may only get 12 sessions approval to provide service for a child, and you don't have time to take a long time to let the child go where they're going to go. In some ways, you may not be working on all their issues. You may just be looking at a specific goal to start off with. So a 12-session type of intervention might make the most sense. I think sometimes in the past done work with children's aid societies, they'll say, these kids are in therapy and they're there for 2 years and no one knows what the heck's going on, and the therapist just sitting in there in a chair, and how is that helpful? And as the therapist who's been sitting in the chair and seeing the child play with things and wonder, where are we going with this? My experience is that when kids have unfinished business and they get into the play therapy room and they use the toys, I trained for 7 years specializing in sand tray as well, which is sand in a specific tray, and I have a wall of miniatures that represent different cultural groups, different generations. There's alcohol bottles, there's penises, there's vaginas, there's images of anything that that may have impacted the child's world, and they can choose it or not choose it, and you invite them to create a world in the sand, or a story in the sand, and with little therapist intervention, just providing the tools and assuring the child that this time is yours, and this space is a safe place, and we're going to work through your issues and the pace we need to work them through. I'm just astounded often how many times kids the work gets done in the sand tray.
And when you're working in the sand tray and you decide to become more directive, would you bring in the liquor bottle? Would you bring in the penis? Would you bring in the different characters for the child and put them there for the child?
No, most often the child's going to do what they need to do, and they'll pick up what they need to pick up. I had there's a book that I wrote a chapter for that's going to be published in the next year, and it was on that my chapter was using sand tray with families, actually, and I was doing a lot of work with adoptive families, and I had this this one little gal who was having a really hard time coming to terms with not seeing biological mother anymore and being involved in this new family with her, with one sibling, both of them adopted into this new family, and coming to terms with, I have a biological mom that I'm not going to see anymore, and I have this other woman around, and I'm, you know, and she's really different than my biological mom, because biological mom, you know, drank all the time and wasn't really there around to help us. And, the mom said, so, like, where do you want me? And I said, little girl, would you like your mommy with us? Do you want her to wait in the waiting room? And she said, oh, no, she can come in with you. She can come in with us. I'd like her in. So she just kind of sat on. I always have a rocking chair in the room. And mom sat on the rocking chair. And the little girl made a sand tray with kids in the sand tray. And then there were monsters around, mummy monsters, she called them around. And, no, she first called them monsters. And then later on said they were mummy monsters. And then put another sand tray, asked me if she could put another sand tray beside the first one, and then said to adoptive mom, come play with me. Then the adoptive mom looked at me like, what should I do? I was like, sure, come play. And so she picked a character for her adoptive mom, and then instructed adoptive mom to come play, and then the monster started being really mean to the children. And the adoptive mom picked up her figure and said, you know, I have to tell the monsters that children are safe here, and it's my job to keep the children safe. And, you know, that whole little interplay happened. And then by the end of the session, basically what happened was the adoptive mom, all in the play, said to the monster, you know, I know you really like the children and it's hard for you to play with them because you don't know what the rules are. And if someone could help you know what the rules are, then maybe you would feel safe and the kids would feel safe. Then the little girl said, the little girl's figures were like, with her super, she called her superhero mom. She said, I feel better here. We can let the monster in the tray then, because as long as you stay with me. Wow. So the mom left the session and went, oh my God, that's the first time she's trusted me to do anything. Do we need to talk about, you know, what this represented for her? And it's like, nope, we don't need to do that either. She did the work within the playroom, and Psyche knows what Psyche needs to do. And therapists don't necessarily, or parents need to draw those concrete connections, because she was working it out for herself.
And just that process of the play and working it out is enough to change Psyche for that.
Yeah,
child.
Begin to maybe open herself up into feeling safe with this new family.
Right. And why choose play therapy as opposed to another form of therapy?
You know what? That's a good question. I am, you know, as a clinician, I can see play therapy being very integrated into many forms of intervention. With I've worked with adolescents who they've referred to me for play therapy, and the kids have come in and said, I'm just really good at, I just want to talk. They're very cognitive. They don't want to do any kind of expressive work. They don't want to use any of the art tools. They don't want to use any of the tools in the playroom. They just want to talk, and that's totally okay. I'm also trained in EMDR, which is bilateral stimulation. You know, that initially was an intervention that was used with adults, but when there's a lot of clinicians now seeing its benefits with kids, also used within play therapy. So play, I think, can be interspersed into a variety of interventions. We just need to be mindful of what we're doing and why. Just like any other kind of intervention that we do with kids.
Right. And then respond to the needs of the individual client. How would you use play therapy with an adolescent? I mean, we can all imagine working with a 5-year-old, a 6-year-old with play therapy. What would it look like working with a 15 or 16-year-old?
Well, there's a couple of points to that. One is, when I did my sanitary training for 6 years in Michigan, many of my colleagues only worked with adults. So some of them ran meth clinics, and, you know, the clients would come in the morning for their methadone doses and then come in back in the afternoon for their addiction counseling, but they use sand tray therapy as part of that, because you're externalizing your issues within the sand tray. And they found it, I keep saying to them, you got to write it up. Like, it'd be really great to write that up so other people are aware that this modality is useful, and and type of treatment is useful with adults. But play therapy gets used with families. With a lot of adolescents that I've worked with in the past, they like to use the sand tray. They don't mind using puppets. We may pull in video cameras and, you know, microphones. So we're taking it to a different level. So they're acting out something. Sometimes books, like using bibliotherapy, reading a book and then that fits with their story. But the other piece to it is play therapists try to always work with kids where they're at developmentally, not necessarily chronologically. And we know that for kids who've experienced trauma, if they've experienced trauma at a latency age, when they get to points when they're in a tough spot and life is really causing them lots of stress and anxiety, they're going to regress to that earlier age. So it kind of makes sense to meet them where they're at, and play therapy can do that.
Right. Yeah, that's a nice way of framing it, that you're working where the person is at emotionally in that particular moment as you're dealing with those particular challenging situations. Yeah. Where does the line shift from play therapy to art therapy to drama therapy to music therapy?
Right. Well, I just kind of, as we're talking, I just looked up what the official definition of play therapy is, and it that's often replicated by play therapy associations around the world, but it started with the Association for Play Therapy in the States, and they define it as the systemic use of a theoretical model to establish an interpersonal process wherein the trained play therapist uses the therapeutic powers of play to help clients prevent or resolve psychosocial difficulties and achieve optimal growth and development. So that fits for me with, you know, all age groups. Even I was in Calgary last week presenting with a gal from a mental health center in York Region, and we were talking about TheraPlay, which is another specific type of play therapy. And in the States, there's places where people are using TheraPlay with senior citizens, because they're looking at the benefits of specific play interventions to help individuals enhance the relationships they have with people around them. So, I think I'm a big believer. I think it's very transferable. And even looking at from the child and youth worker perspective, we've known about play for a long time. Mm-hmm. And talked about, I mean, in the Bible of child and youth worker, the other 23 hours, they talked about, you know, using every kind of moment interacting with a client can be a therapeutic one. And if kids are in the other 23 hours, the title of that book came from the belief that kids may have been in therapy for an hour, but what happens the other 23 hours in a child's day? And how can we use all of those moments where we meet kids to make it a therapeutic exchange and a therapeutic opportunity? And play can be, you know, not necessary. It doesn't have to be just in the play therapy room. It can be at the dinner table. It can be while you're doing chores. It can be while you're outside. It can be when you're walking in the forest. You know, when you're listening to music. And I mean, I got into this little kind of discussion around the formal definition, because you talked about what about art therapy? What about music therapy? And I think aspects of all of those things are really all part of play therapy. I had an intern that I was supervising that was really stuck with an adolescent. She's like, I'm not quite sure where to go with this. And we talked about all the things she tried. And I said, well, she likes music, right? And she said, yeah. And I said, why don't you get her to identify a song that represents all of the key times that she's had in her life. And even if so, through her developmental periods, a song she remembers when she was a little kid, a song she remembers when she was, you know, in grade 3, a song she remembers in grade 6. And they did that, and she was like, oh my gosh, I couldn't believe how powerful that was. She then started talking about, you know, all the good and bad times she'd had in her life. And then unfortunately what happened is all of a sudden this child had some serious significant medical issues and ended up losing her memory and was hospitalized and was having multiple seizures, and no one could figure out what the heck was going on. And the mom said, I don't know what to do. And I said, okay, you know, I think when we work with kids, whether we're child and youth workers or play therapists, we always do the oath of confidentiality, right? You know, we're not going to disclose what happens, or if we are going to disclose, it's going to be, you know, at the end of the 12 weeks, we're going to have a case conference and you're going to help, you know, prepare the report for that, and you'll be engaged in that process. In this case, we had a kid who was nonverbal, having a hard time remembering anything about her life, and was having seizures consistently throughout the day. And the mom was like, she just recognizes me and no one else. So I talked with the clinician, and we decided to say to the mom, you know, if you go to her journal, there's going to be a piece of paper in there with all the songs she'd picked. Why don't you put them on her MP3 player and let her listen to them? And so they did that, and sure enough, memory starts coming again.
Wow.
And you go, wow, that's the power of music. I mean, there's so much we're learning more and more about the brain, and the research is coming in a flurry, it seems. Every other day, there's a story of something else. So it kind of makes sense that expressive activities help create new templates for kids, and reinforcement of those templates can help them get through developmental phases.
Yeah.
So looking at all the work of Bruce Perry and others right now around trauma and attachment disruptions, the brain's pretty powerful. And there's a lot of discussion happening in the field right now about the power of play and the power of theraplay and the power of those repetitious and actions between children and their parents and children and therapists or, you know, significant attachment figures, how that can help them repair some of the areas where, that they're struggling in.
It's been said before that play therapy is not, the client's not the child, the client's not the parents, the client is the relationship amongst all the players in the family. And that really struck me, that play therapy is about building relationships through that, whatever means the child needs to express those relationships. And you mentioned the pressure around, you know, evidence based and cognitive behavioral therapy and time sensitive. And it's so impressive to hear that the expressive arts are being recognized as having that impact,
because
it's unusual. Usually the first programs to get cut in schools, the first things to get, you know, dumped in therapy. So it's really nice that there's a recognition of the expressive arts.
I think we need to, like, I know in our own play therapy world, I was just coming from Calgary, and I heard from clinicians who work in certain parts of Calgary, and I can't reference this accurately with, you know, which jurisdiction or where the written article was about, but I had a couple of therapists say, I work in, you know, this zone of Calgary, and not only has funding been cut for all therapeutic interventions, but foster care, foster parents, you know, who may have been getting a per diem of $50 a day are now down to $15 a day.
Wow.
And I think, wow, like, what does that do? It may be a short-term budgetary intervention, but when you look at needing, say, foster parents that need to stay home because kids have multiple appointments and, you know, get suspended from school twice a week, it's going to be really difficult for them to carry on service, and that's just going to lead to things like placement breakdown.
Oh, completely.
Absolutely. And then with the lack of, I mean, we all at different times in our careers see the funding shifts of, like, look at the recent kind of news of Thistletown closing down.
Mm-hmm.
You go, as a clinician, you step back and say, we've seen this before, and then we're going to see that kids suffer, and then someone's going to come in and go, well, that wasn't a very good decision. We need to integrate, you know, more resources or find the supports for them, whether it's, you know, increasing per diem payments or providing interventions. It's tough to stand back and watch and see. There's a lot of kids that don't get the therapy that they need, or families that don't get the supports that they need. And I know in the play therapy community, one thing that I've been advocating for is that for someone to get certified as a child psychotherapist, play therapist, they need to have at least 2,000 hours of clinical practice, and it's supervised. And that's tough to gather. But there are some therapists in different parts of Canada that, you know, are creating partnerships with local communities, you know, community centers, so they can refer kids who need services for nothing, for interns that are trying to get their hours that are supervised by a supervisor that's willing to do that, so that kids can get the services that they need. Because we know that these help. and they're not the only type of intervention that helps. Therapy is only one part of the puzzle. It's only 1 hour of the other, you know, of the 24, right?
Yes,
and the other ones are really important too.
Yeah.
And also I think play therapists have, there's shift too. There isn't, in the public's eye as well, it isn't just play therapists are working with little kids, but they work with teenagers and they can work with families. And wow, if we can, as a play therapist, I can also work with a family and support them, support the parents in their role so that the child doesn't need to come to therapy, then I've done a good job.
And what does that look like? How do we work with parents to carry on the play with the child for the other 23 hours?
I think most of the referrals that I got when I was doing doing lots of intensive adoptive work, I found I would always start off with a consult with the parents. And I think, and that's where my child and youth worker hat comes on really well, because I would have colleagues say, oh, wow, like, how'd you know to say that? You know, when parents are talking about struggling with routines you know, struggling with communication with their kids. And coming with a child and youth worker lens, in addition to my play therapist lens, really lent nicely to that population and client group, because I would do the consultation first and find out, you know, what are you really struggling with? Because if they're struggling with, you know, this kid isn't sleeping, and that means I'm not sleeping, and that means, you know, dad's having a hard time getting to work on time, talking about playing with them is the last thing on their minds. Like, it's that Maslow's hierarchy of needs stuff, right? So as a child and youth worker, I could help them with all that parenting strategies and supports information so that they at least got those immediate needs addressed. And then they could hear me when I said, okay, so let's talk about, you know, what kind of fun are you having? Are you, you know, if you're power struggling with this kid all the time, it must be really hard to say, hey, let's go for a walk to the park, or, you know, let's sit close and let me read you a story. Or if you're, you know, you're adopting a child who has pretty severe attachment issues, they're not going to let that parent get that close to tell them a story. So how can you teach them the skills to engage the child so that the child sees the parent as not only a potential safe adult, but a fun adult? And TheraPlay works for that. And again, a lot of people look at TheraPlay, that form of play therapy, as being only for little kids, but I've used it really effectively with latency age kids as well.
Could you just elaborate a little bit what you mean by TheraPlay?
Yeah, it's the reference would be the TheraPlay Institute, so listeners could Google that, and there's lots of research articles on their web page about why it's effective. But TheraPlay, when I did the training, I don't know, 6 years ago, the first part of it was group TheraPlay, and I was in there thinking, we did this in child and youth worker school. Like, these are a lot of the same activities, but the activities, it wasn't just, well, let's, you know, do this activity or that activity. They really look at the parent-child relationship. They focus on four pillars, which would be the parent being able to provide the child with structure, being able to nurture the child, being able to engage the child, and being able to create activities that challenge the child. So the child can say, you know, they can say, you can tie your shoes, let me show you how we can do this. Or, you know, you are able to zip your zipper up on your coat, I'm going to show you, we're going to practice it, and it'll be okay, you'll be able to do it. Or whatever other challenge activities are required in the child's life. So looking at those four domains, there's a specific assessment that gets done that's, again, a play-based assessment. And then the therapist would review the videotape of that play experience with the parent. And often what showed up in the assessment in terms of what areas the child or parent struggled in unison with the child really replicated what was happening day to day in the home environment.
And would you go through all those four domains in each session or over the course of the 12 weeks?
Well, in the assessment, you would go through all four domains right away, and then you would pick like the top two that you're going to focus on. And then in your subsequent play sessions, pick activities that provided the parent with the opportunity and the child to practice the skills under that domain in a very fun way. And then as that got better, then you could move to the next one if that was a concern too. Right.
And then they would do that both in the session as well as ultimately, hopefully, the parents would do that outside of the room as well.
Absolutely. But they may just start with doing, you know, 6 to 10 sessions with the therapist and then be working on that outside of the play therapy sessions. That said, I've had some parents where I knew they weren't in a position to engage in TheraPlay for a bit for a whole bunch of reasons. So I could say to them, okay, so if you're really struggling with if your child's really struggling with nurture, or with structure, with you being in charge and giving them, you know, the parameters of what they need to be, here are some activities that you can utilize to practice that in a fun way at home, and then let me know how that goes.
What might be some of the activities that you would give as an example?
Well, for a little kid, one that I was doing with adults in a room just yesterday in Calgary was I would have them pair up and we would put like a soft toy on their head, and you have the child and the parent look at each other, make eye contact, and hold hands, but the hands are upright to catch the toy that's on the head. So the child would have the toy on their head, and the parent would be instructed to blink, and when the parent blinked, the child dropped the toy on the hand and they caught it together. So it sounds like, well, what's the big deal with that? But what you're practicing is the parent and the child are holding hands. So for a kid who's having a hard time engaging with that parent in a nurturing kind of way, they're doing that. You're also encouraging the child to look at the parent, because the parent's going to give them the signal of when it's okay to do the task. And, you know, the parent then gets pretty playful around that. And then when the child is able to do it and they both catch it, then they, you know, you instruct the parent to make a big deal about that, so the kid gets excited that, wow, we did this together, mom and dad and I.
Right. And all within a very clear structure, yeah. Very, very clear framework.
Yeah, and then, but then that those skills can be transferred into the life space by saying to the parent, so now what that means is, you know, when you're in church and the kid's giving you a hard time about sitting in church, you can come up with eye signals to let them know, you know, when it's okay to leave the pew, or, you know, when it's okay to pull a book out of the bag. So they start getting in the habit of looking to that parent for direction and structure about what's, you know, what they can do when, special winks and stuff at the family dinner table to engage. And then there's another activity, again, a little kid one, stack of hands, where, you know, the child puts their hand, the parent puts it on top, and you make it, you know, you go up the aisle to a tower and then do it underneath, and then I'll have parents and kids do it with their eyes closed, and you think, wow, that's not that big of a deal. But again, it's touch. It's, you know, the child, for the kids we work with that really like to be in charge all the time and have a really hard time allowing the adults to take the lead, they can only be successful if they take their turn.
Right.
And they can only be successful if they follow the cadence of the parent. So helping the parent, you know, go fast, go slow. And I had a client in the summertime send me a picture of a photography session. They were having their first family photo done after adoption, and the child, even though he's, how old is he? But he was about 2.5, and he was exposed to drugs and alcohol in utero, so probably is going to be a candidate for an FASD diagnosis, or neurobehavioral alcohol disorder diagnosis, as we call it in Ontario. And he was just all over the place, and the parent said, and I remembered in our session, stack of hands. So, you know, while they're sitting in the photography session, she started doing stack of hands, and he just started to calm down, and the photographer caught the picture of it.
Wow.
And so she sent the picture, and I was like, wow. So again, a little playful activity, but because he was used to seeing that as, you know, I'm going to follow mom's lead, and while she's doing that, she would practice getting him to breathe a little bit more slowly and calm himself down. And it was a successful photo shoot. They were really happy, and she also felt really empowered that when he's getting dysregulated and all over the place, she can pull out a whole bunch of different play activities rather than just say, sit still. You need to be quiet. Instead, she's playing with him, and he settles himself down.
I think so often we think children are just playing, or people are just playing, and having you break it down for us like this, of this is what is behind this play, this is what's behind that play, this is the longer term implications potentially, really helps us frame how play is therapeutic.
And for child and youth workers that are listening, you know, when you're at the group home and you're pulling out a game, that game, you're not only spending time and having fun together and hopefully enhancing the relationship with the child, but you could also be teaching them to take turns, or, you know, experience a little bit of winning or maybe a little bit of losing, or, you know, making eye contact before they're taking the next term because they struggle with that in their social skills. I think in the child and youth care field, we've been using play in, you know, direct teaching kind of ways for a long, long time. And I know as a prof of child and youth workers, they're really good at picking activities. But then when you say, okay, so what's the therapeutic goal? Besides having fun, sometimes students struggle with breaking that down. But when you help them, you know, talk a little bit, get a little bit about the child's history, and then look at what the treatment goals are, it's easy to look at, well, these are kind of activities when you're on shift you could be pulling out to be working towards that goal. So it's just helping them understand that what they're doing, they know it works, but sometimes they don't always know why it works.
Yes, well said.
We're going to wrap it up. I really want to thank you so much, and it's so intriguing, and there's so many possibilities. And I know that the Canadian Association for Child and Play Therapy, you do regular trainings. I know you have some coming up. If people want to find out more, you referenced the TheraPlay Association. Where else can people find more information about play therapy?
Well, they could look at, if they look at the Canadian Association for Child and Play Therapy. You're right. We have a program that has been happening in London for years. There's three levels to it. Most individuals who go into that program have a master's level degree to begin the process of becoming child psychotherapist. But Canada also invites child and youth workers to participate in the program.
Great.
Recognizing the wonderful training that CYWs often come to the program with because of psychology, counseling, and child development, and, you know, therapeutic interventions. So we do have members of our association that instead certify to become play therapy associates, which means they're more closely supervised, but they, you know, can go through the process as well. So we have the program happening in London in May, June, and for the first time, there's a Toronto level one happening in July. And then for those listeners that are in BC, the certificate program for the first time is going out to BC in August. And we invite individuals, if they don't want to necessarily sign up to certify, they're more than welcome to pick any of the topics and just come for professional development. So we often advertise all of the programs in the, you know, with the Ontario Association of Child and Youth Counselors, because we do have CYWs come and, you know, just do one day on one topic or one day on another topic. So listeners are more than welcome to sign up for those programs. We would love to have more child and youth workers represented there. And then there's the Play Therapy, the International Journal of Play Therapy, which is in most university libraries under EBSCO if students are looking under their journals. And I'm sure Humber can access some of those articles too. And then the Association for Play Therapy has an APT website, and they list any kind of up-to-date news around play therapy on their website all the time. And also, if you look at the Canadian Association, a list of all the certified members in Canada are there, and I'm one of them. And I also have a radio show called Changing Steps on Blog Talk Radio, and I don't have as many interviews in the can as you do, so kudos to you. But you know, it's growing. And the other thing is that CACPT is looking at, we're going to be launching on our online learning site very soon, so that people can get some continuing ed, because we get requests from all over the country, from folks from, you know, isolated areas like the Northwest Territories. And we had two delegates from Newfoundland last week, and they said there's just no training for us in this part of the country. And as an association, we want to make sure it's available to everyone. So if we can't be there in person, then we're trying to come up with other ways to provide training for people so that they can access training information. So it's out there if people look. And if any of your listeners are, you know, just want to talk personally, they're welcome to email me. It's just my name, Teresa Fraser at rogers.com, TheresaFraser at rogers.com, and I'd be happy to connect them with a therapist in their jurisdiction.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Thank you very, very much, Teresa. I really appreciate it.
Okay, bye.